Welcome to episode 4 of the Be Connected podcast. Today we have a fantastic story and insights and also a great connection for the LGBTI community. Chris Scavello is a part of the Scavello group, and it's a fantastic conversation that we have about his history and the development of this amazing group. They are somebody that you would probably know in the industry, and they have a fantastic reputation. So what's his story been, and how has he also developed Building Pride? Now, Building Pride is an LGBTI community that brings together people in their built environment, as well as trying to make a difference in creating more inclusive environments. So let's dive on in and find out a little bit more. Chris, thank you so much for joining us on the Be Connected podcast today. It's an absolute pleasure. So, look, what we want to have a little bit of discussion is that you actually lead the group Building Pride. So we want to have a little bit of a discussion about that. And you and I have met for that a few years ago, a little bit of the story and what you're doing and that as well. But, look, let's start off on more of the personal note to start with. So, obviously, Chris, you do hold one of those names that's quite well-renowned in the industry. So tell us a little bit about the Scavello group and how that's kind of come to be, and you know, your journey through that as well.
Cool. Yeah, I do have a very familiar family name. People always say Scavello or Scavello. It is Scavello.
Scavello.
Best way to remember that. Yeah, the best way to remember that, my father always says, is like SCH, you say school. So that's always the best way to kind of remember how to say it. But I'm very fortunate to grow up in a family business like this. I think we're quite lucky that, you know, we are quite diverse and we do lots of things, but we always stay, in the property industry. But I definitely think it's an industry that's given us a lot. Having started out, both my father and my uncle started out as petitioners, and then they became joiners, and then they wanted to control the process. So then they started doing a little bit more manufacturing, because back then builders used to have, you know, all the skills under their house. They used to have all the tradesmen under their banner. Whereas now, you know, a construction manager is effectively just managing safety, managing risk, managing program, and everything subcontracted out. So yeah, through that process, they wanted to kind of control a lot of the things that they would be delivering on site from a quality perspective, and also from an assurance when it came to program. And that kind of led them to bring in some machinery to then start to manufacture. And probably up until, I would say, the somewhere to the late 90s, and it was before I had started, that's what they were doing. Most of our projects, if you were to look at everything that was installed and being built in the we do fit out, so a lot of interiors, partition sections, glass, all the aluminium, and we even, at one point we were doing our own soft wiring. A lot of people know us for doing workstations, and obviously the flow-on effect is just some of the loose furniture, ceiling systems as well. We had an electrical business. So, yeah, we used to kind of have everything under the one banner.
But then, did you start them up, if you ask, or because I'm obviously interested always on the business side of things, or did you guys sort of take on other businesses? Because it's interesting, because it's all about the quality control, it sounds like, and being able to control how things are going to be.
It's funny, if you ever meet my father and my uncle, they're very detailed people. They love the details. They're polar opposite to me. I'm like high level helicopter person. Just like, just straight to the point. But it was never actually about acquiring businesses. They would always like to find the right people that they could grow businesses with.
Yeah, wow.
And I think that's been, I suppose, a huge part of why we've been so successful, is actually having a lot of not just employees, but people that, we're given shareholding in businesses, and these businesses would sit, on their own little two feet. And they would obviously, they'll do get work for the broader Scavello business, and they could also go and work, for other companies as well.
Yeah, fascinating. So, that's brilliant, actually, because we often talk about that, because it takes a lot of capital, or from an entrepreneurial point of view, different people have different skill sets. And obviously, you see a lot of tech companies do this where they'll look for somebody to come onto their board or to be involved in the business who's got that ability. So once your family's actually gone through and created the process, somebody might be very good electrician and very good at that quality, but they might not be that great at actually running the business or knowing all of those factors, or having the connections to be able to get the contracts to do it. So great benefit to being able to do. Very interesting. I didn't know that. So that's and it's great because then you get to see somebody else flourish and grow their business,
yeah,
and let them do their thing, but with the support system as well behind them.
Yeah, and obviously we're a business now that's in other countries and in Australia. And I think if you were to look back in terms of when they started to expand that, and that just through, you know, some global contracts and some, you know, federal government contracts here and national contracts as well. But the hardest part, the hardest or the biggest challenge to expanding, because I think a lot of businesses talk about, you know, growth and expansion. And I don't think I think it's often underestimated what that actually requires. I think it's more than just, it's an idea. It is really about trying to find the right people, you know, finding the right people that share, you know, the same values, the same ethics, that are just as committed, reliable, you know, consistency. You know, these are things that, you know, you don't really know about people that you go into business with until, you know, I suppose you're in the fight or in the battle. So it is. It's a pretty fascinating business when you kind of look at it. You are 59 years old in 1 month's time.
Wow.
Next year will be 60.
So when did they start it? They must have started it so young.
My father was born in 1945 and it was started in 1966.
Oh, wow. So,
yeah. Not bad when you consider they came on the, you know, they literally came on a boat and they didn't speak English and you didn't have Google images to Google what Australia looked like. I'm sure they probably had their idea of what it looked like, when they were coming here. But yeah,
that's incredible. What a story.
Yeah.
Okay, so I didn't realize they actually immigrated. Is that right? Or they came out after the war, actually, when it was sort of those, awesome, you know, 10 pound ponds and a lot of, right. Well, we had a very interesting conversation, as I mentioned before, with Pragya talking about, you know, in this case, second generation, you know, obviously your parents coming or your family coming over here. So that's what a fantastic story. And I think that's the thing, as everybody needs to remember, is that Australia is actually built on people having a go and giving a go and even getting on a boat, not knowing what's going to be ahead of you. Good on them. Absolutely. And so how's that feel now being that second generation coming through? Because, you know, you're a director in the company and you run the construction side. Is that correct? I mean, obviously know each other more from Building Pride than we know on a professional level. So tell me a little bit about what that's been. Has it always been assumed that you would go into the business, or has it always come through?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I always tell people I never really know what I want to do. And I'm always looking for what my career is. But it doesn't really matter what I'm doing. I've always given it, I think, 100%. And I think I've always said, you know, as long as I'm enjoying it, I'll, you know, continue to do so, and I'll find ways to entertain myself and do different things. And my father used to always drag me into all of us, and my sisters as well, that we didn't have school holidays, that we would get, you know, thrown into the factory. So that, you know, I think he was probably doing it to give my mum a break, to be fair. So it's like, school holidays, you're coming with me. And, you know, you'd be in there, you know, basically counting components, like, you know, the little Ziploc bags that you get in IKEA for with all the screws and stuff.
Yeah,
we would do the same thing, because I'd send them out to sites with some of the components that would make up workstations or joinery pieces. And as soon as I turned 15, I went and got a job, and I was like, yes, thank God, I don't need to be up at 6:30 on my school holidays to be going into the factory at 7 o'clock. And, you know, factories during the winter in Melbourne winter aren't known for being very warm. I'm pretty sure the industrial relations back then were a little bit lighter on. So, I still didn't, like, when I turned 15, I was pretty much like, see you later, Skibello. I was just, you know, wanting to make my own money. You know, just worked at pizza places, worked in retail. Retail was always fun. Be a bit of a store manager and a stock boy, as well as, you know, selling on the shop floor. And I think I was just one of those people that, as long as I was making a dollar, and, you know, working with good people, I didn't really care. Didn't really care what I did. And then
I think a lot of people are like that. It's like, you just want to go to work and like the people you're working with, you know, what you're doing can be a secondary, you know, as long as you're building it with the right people around you.
And then I was, you know, straight out of school into university. I hated studying, which is ironic because I probably enjoy learning now. And then when I turned 19, I went on holidays to a resort company called Club Med, and I, ended up getting a job there, much to my parents' shock and displeasure. I said, bring them, and I said, just so you know, I'm not coming home. And they were like, what do you mean you're not coming home? I said, well, I've got a job. And I said, what do you mean?
See, hang on, like, you went on the holiday to Club Med just for 2 weeks. I've been to Club Med. I grew up in Club Med. Best thing for parents, if anybody is out there, honestly. I cannot wait until my kids can go to Club Med. Off you go. I can sit down. But, like, it's amazing because it does absolutely everything and the entertaining and the system. I can actually see you doing that and just, I mean, I love the buzz of all that. People on holidays, they need to relax.
Yeah.
And they want all that. But, wow. So you just were like, I love this. So I'm going to do it. Good on you.
So, yeah, and can you guess what role I did in Club Med?
Entertainment, I feel like.
Yeah, you know what, can I tell you, everyone freaks out, but I was actually a really quiet child. I don't know where I get my confidence from now. No, funnily enough, yes, but I actually ended up in the circus team. And not that I am an acrobat. I was like,
give it a go.
I was like, I think I can learn flying trapeze. I mean, I landed on my head a few times. Have no grace, no poise, no pointed toes, but I learned the hard way. But I think it taught a lot about me, about myself, that, you know, if you learn to, you know, you're in a team environment, had a great leader at the time, a little Japanese guy, Makoto, and I think, you know, you learn to listen and to your leader, and if they feel that you're ready to, I suppose, you know, you do a lot of, like, tricks through the air, and you know, you take off your safety lines. If they're basically saying, yep, take them off, you're good. You're thinking, okay, all right, this person's saying I can do it, so yeah, let's just have a crack. You know, what's the worst that can happen? So yeah, it teaches you a lot about yourself.
So you can actually do the trapeze. Is this what we're actually learning here as well?
I could. I mean, it's been 17, 18 years, and I mean, I still got all my costumes and stuff. And look, I'd probably. If I had about 2 months worth of training, I reckon I could do it. But yeah.
Wow. That. Okay. Then, that's a new fact I didn't know. Right. Wow. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
So then what happened after that? Oh, you can juggle too. Well, that's it. Next show, that's it. I'm going to bring some.
It's great. If you ever, the best thing about juggling is if you ever have a child that's crying and they cry for nothing, and if you just start randomly juggling balls in front of them, they just stop. They just this look on their face like, I don't know what's happening. And they forget about their tears and while they're upset, and they just get this shock and awe. It's great. You should try it one time.
I will. I think I have to improve my juggling skills now for my 3 and my 4-year-old. Absolutely. So you came to Club Med. How long did you do that for?
Just under 2 years. I worked in three different. I worked in Australia, I worked in Indonesia, and I worked in Malaysia.
Oh,
and I came back because I was done. You know, pay was horrible, and I just gave myself some time. Came back to work for the family business, to which my sister said, are you sure you want to do this? Because you know that this is for life. And
I don't know if many of us have that job where it's like, you're in. Is that what it's like? You're in or you're out? That's it. Once you're on the track.
Yeah. I think she said to me, I'm pretty sure she said to me, she goes, you know, you can't have kids like me and just be like, see, yeah, I'm pregnant. You know, which is fair, I suppose. But I thought, why not? I didn't really know what I wanted to do. And again, I said I'd always continue to do it as long as I enjoy it. And I think any good company that you work for gives their staff creative freedom to, I suppose, create their own, you know, or allow them to take, you know, to take the role and have a little bit of opportunity to define it for themselves. And even though I kind of say I'm not a creative person, I definitely think there's a level of creative freedom where it's always, and it's not just me, and this comes from, I think, our family values and what's made this business so great is we've always allowed people in this business to be able to, you know, come to us with new ideas. And, you know, our mantra from, you know, my Uncle Tony was always anything is possible. And it's true. Like, I don't think there's ever been, you know, I think if you look to how our business has grown and how we've shifted into other, you know, industries and other sectors and other fields, it's because people have come to us with ideas. And, you know, we've looked at the person, we've looked at the idea, and we've said, oh, we think that there's something there. And, you know, that's brilliant. Kind of how it's kind of, yeah. So there's, you know, people talk about entrepreneurial spirit, and I think that's a really important thing.
Yeah.
But I also don't think that it ever comes from one person. I feel like, you know, you put entrepreneurs on a pedestal. And I don't think that one person has all the ideas, but I think it's about the culture and the environment that they create that allows people to come in and you're fostering creativity.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's quite funny, we're obviously going to talk a bit about the psych safety that you've done. That's obviously one of the things, you know, when we talk about psych safety from a WHS perspective, it is having people having that autonomy within their role and not going to work and being a robot. And I think that's it. I mean, that's the thing we're going to talk about really is, you know, a psychologically safe workplace is actually a workplace that people thrive and you can achieve amazing things. So actually creating an environment where you're going, you know what, there's an idea and that stacks up, let's give it a go. And I think that is the entrepreneurial spirit at the end of the day is let's give it a go. If it works, it works. If not, we have a go. We've had a look at it. We put some restraints on it, how far it's going to go. But if we don't have a go, you never know. So because you guys have like about, we're going to move on to Building Pride now, but you've got about 50 parts of your business. Is that right? Or is that completely incorrect? Like
there's some crazy number. To be honest with you, there's a lot of things in our business that I don't even know that we do that. I actually find out from other people. And then I go up and see, you know, my dad or my uncle. And they're great communicators, but they're also horrible communicators in the sense that you find out from other people and you ask the question. And then I'm like, oh, that was good to know. And they're like, oh, well, you didn't ask me. That's why I didn't tell you. And I'm like, and our business is actually so big and there's not that many family involved in it. But in a sense, it's actually quite good because, again, we've kind of all got our freedom and our autonomy to do our own thing. Yeah. So there's a lots of different parts of our business, and I think that's super important. And I think that's why we're still around today is because we have diversified. And I think, you know, people always talk about change in a bad way, or especially when you look at the last 5 years, which has probably, I suppose, expedited that process or at least unearthed some of the, you know, deficiencies in industries or in businesses. Change is a natural part of business, and if you don't change, you know, you get left behind, or you won't exist.
Yeah, continuously evolving. And I think, you know, obviously there's big talk at the moment. One of our podcasts we've done is on AI, and I think obviously what we're going to see in the next 20 years is going to be a massive change again, particularly for knowledge workers versus, you know, I think we'll find the construction industry and the trade side of the industry will definitely be there, but it's definitely going to be an evolution of the way that we work. And you can see people either you get on board and you get okay that change is just going to be the part, but it also means with change, there's new opportunities, there's new things available. Yeah. And that's where it's constantly, you know, thinking ahead. I think the great thing is that if you do within a business, if you actually are fostering that and let's have a go, but you've also got actually that brilliant part. You kind of know what it takes to run a good business and you know the minimum things that you need to be doing. That's it. It's how you replicate that. And I think that's where I would say that you guys have done very, very well in that. I mean, there would not be very many people and businesses with that much diversity that continue. I'm sure there's been things where they haven't worked out, as you said, but having that diversity of, okay, well, let's pursue that idea. Let's go with that. Let's see where it leads. Has that actually come? But probably still with the same base of let's make sure that we do it right. We've got the right search.
Yeah.
So that probably leads me on to where we're actually here to mainly talk about today. So let's talk a bit about Building Pride and where all of this idea came from. So obviously, you know, I'm involved in this group. I wanted to sort of understand a little bit of, you know, obviously if you wouldn't mind sharing a little bit of your coming out or, you know, coming in particularly into an industry that's, you know, we know I think is a lot more friendly, you know, than is in other industries. Tell me a little bit about your personal evolution and coming out, and then we want to go into Building Pride.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I think as I get older, I look at my nieces and my nephews, and I kind of try to understand, you know, who are they and where are they and what is their identity? And I try to understand if it's, I think, look, everybody goes through trying to work out who they are. And obviously the, you know, the family environment that you grow up in and the people you surround yourself with do play a big part of that. And I think giving you a level of comfort in, you know, and confidence, you know, and also freedom to allow you to be, you know, whoever you want to be and explore those things and celebrate that. I think the challenge for me was, and I didn't come out until I was 21 till I was like 26, thereabouts, was I think it's, you know, within myself, it's like me trying to find out, you know, where do I fit in, you know, and you know, you look at schools, right? Schools are all about, you know, little cliques and little groups, and, you know, you have the nerds and the jocks and the, you know, the musicians and all these types of things. That's so stereotypical. And, you know, I think for me, it was about trying to work out, well, you know, where do I fit in? I, you know, if you were to look at me, I think probably let's start with, well, I suppose, the LGBTQ community. And, you know, keeping in mind that, you know, I was born in 1987 and I grew up in the sort of late 90s and the early 2000s, about, you know, when you are trying to work that out is, you know, I suppose the unfortunate thing is you only see a snippet of what that community looks like. So that snippet is, you know, what you see on TV. And there are shows like, you know, Queer as Folk, and, you know, that's the first one that comes to my mind. As a snippet, as opposed to what does it mean to be?
You and I are the same age. Like, there wasn't really anything on television. There wasn't spoken about. I mean, it wasn't a bad thing. Like, you and I'm 1985, so the same type of thing, same type of age. And as you said, probably different. I ended up having a lot of gay friends. I was like, oh, okay, let's give that a go. No, I'm kidding. It was like, okay, well, that's all cool, fun, right? But at the same time, I look at it now and obviously there's a lot more awareness around it, so I think the experience is different. But talking about the TV, there wasn't necessarily that much. I mean, this is a time when, you know, in the 90s, when Ellen came out, it was like she was dismissed. And then, you know, through the 2000s, somebody like that's now become like, you know, the Oprah in a different way. Now, obviously, your show doesn't exist. But in essence, the conversation, what's out there and what people are open about has obviously changed dramatically. But we're in our, well, I'm now 40, you're in your late 30s, but we're also working with people who are of a different generation as well, and also cultural impacts or social impacts that have on that as well. So, I mean, I've recently moved from Victoria to Queensland, as you're aware, and it's not a bad thing. Everybody's very lovely, but it's just not really a thing, right? Like we go to schools and it's like, oh, we're a rainbow family. And it's like, oh, okay, everybody's cool with it. But you're like, oh, there's just nobody around really who is gay or sort of visible. So talk to us, going back to your story a little bit. So you're back in the, that would have been early 2000s?
Early 2000s. And I think it's, you know, and again, everybody's trying to find their identity. And I think obviously the layer of, you know, your sexuality just adds a little complication to that, because, you know, you've got conversations and girlfriends and boyfriends and, you know, in the heterosexual world and going out to house parties and, you know, those types of things. So I think, you know, you're trying to work out and say, well, if that's not me, then what is me? And so when you're looking for what is you and you don't have, I suppose, that you can't, you know, and there is that adage of, you know, you can't be what you can't see. You know, when you had shows like that, which are quite, you know, probably mildly entertaining for me at this age, because now I suppose I understand them and I can laugh at them. But, you know, if that's what I suppose the community and the culture that you see, you know, it's very hard to identify that with. So I think growing up, it's about, you know, how do you kind of normalize it in a sense that just show that you don't have to live in a world of stereotypes. And it took me a while, I think, and, you know, people, maybe, you know, I told you the story about, you know, going and doing this, you know, the circus stuff before, and I was a shy kid. Maybe that is part of me, you know, subconsciously trying to find out and find my own confidence and to try to make me challenge myself, because I'm a really determined and stubborn individual when it comes to these things. Anyone that knows me will say that. I do like to, you know, I suppose, question myself a lot. And so maybe that was just part of this kind of psychological process that I went on to basically say, well, you can't do that, or can you? You know, maybe you can do anything. Maybe you can be anything. Maybe you can. And so as much as at the time my parents didn't want me to go, I kind of ultimately blamed them, because, you know what, they gave me the kind of level of confidence and comfort to basically say, you can do anything you want to if you put your mind to it.
Yeah, and that's fantastic things to have installed in you as a kid, essentially, as well. So, you know, if you want to go and do the trapeze, you could do it. And no rope, the person says it's fine, it's good to go. So you fall onto that. Yeah. So how was that? Was there any things in your family? Was it, you know, and we are talking different ages and stages.
Yep. It's look, I think coming up, I think with a lot of people, and again, I always say I've got a brilliant family. I've got, you know, they're super supportive coming out, you know, my father's born in 45, my mother in 54, ethnic background as well. So, you know, and they were really supportive. You know, obviously I've got three older sisters, which, you know, always does help in most cases. So I always say to people, like, my coming out story, I think the hardest part was the, you know, I suppose the pressure and the questioning that you put on yourself, which is why, you know, when I kind of wanted to do something like Building Pride, it was always fundamentally about, you know, how do you create, or how do you be visible for, you know, people in our industry and that I suppose want to build a career and, you know, want to aspire to, you know, achieve something beyond just turning up to work every single day. And I think the hardest challenge that I found was, you know, as I was saying before, is, you know, okay, what does it mean to be gay, right, for me? You know, well, if I'm, you know, I'm sports loving, I'm, you know, I'm sports mad, I want to be successful in life, you know, with, yeah, you know, my family relationships and, yeah, with business. Where do you see that? So, you know, where are examples where you looked at? You might have snippets, and I know this is a little bit, you know, controversial, but, you know, at the time you had Alan Joyce, the CEO of, you know, Qantas, was probably the most prominent, you know, member of the community when it comes to business success. So, you know, I think, you know, how do you now start to show that there are other people out there doing great things that maybe, and we had a prime minister once, you know, Julia Gillard, who said that, you know, she said that she, you know, it wasn't easy, but she hopes that she made it easier for this generation and the next, and, you know, the one after, yeah, that. And I think for me, that's always stuck with me, which has always been like, you know, we've got a responsibility to kind of make it easier for, you know, this generation and the next one. And I think often I never personally forget about those before us who have had, you know, who've had it harder than what we did, who, oh, you know, absolutely, suffered violence, abuse, and, you know, the mental health side of it, to, you know, you hear stories about, you know, murders and, you know, but even the smallest action that they talk about being visible or protesting, because we forget that Mardi Gras started as a protest,
but
that visibility where they literally put their life at risk, and, you know, and socially shunned, you know, these are the things that they risk.
Yeah.
They laid the foundations for us. And I think that if we can do something that lays foundations to make it easier for the next generation, I feel that's kind of what we should be doing. So that's why we started Building Pride.
So because it started in the middle of COVID, or just before COVID, I think you did a bit of a call out. So where did the idea come from? And then you went, hey, and then I think you sort of doing as you do, you sort of test things out and ask people, and it's evolved, you know, whilst you're sort of spearheading it because somebody needs to make sure stuff happens. You are very collaborative in your approach with things. So let's sort of just go through a little bit of the history and the dates and sort of where it's been and what the expansion's been as well.
Yeah, it did start out as like a rambling conversation. It actually, where I wanted to get involved was mentoring. And there is a group out there that actually specialised in LGBTQ mentoring, but they didn't do it for property and construction. But I reached out to them, and I think they do banking and finance and more.
Yeah.
And then they said to me, look, a year later I got an email and they're like, oh, a couple of you have all approached us about mentoring in, you know, construction and property. You should all get together. Here are your emails. So we started a bit of a group and a conversation. And then from that, this group became like a meeting, and there were like 20, 25 people in it. And to be honest with you, no one was getting outcomes. And I actually had somebody from our office go as a representative who then refused to go because the meeting and they weren't getting, there's nothing happening. And then I came along and I said, look, let me come. Let me see if I can, you know, put some structure around this thing. Walked into a room with 30 people. And there was one person who I think had tried to put in some process at the start. And I said, what does everyone want to get out of this? You know, you're all meeting here. You're all giving up your time. Clearly you're passionate. Why don't we just run a blind survey? And I want you just to tell me, what do you want to get out of it? And then what we'll do, you give me that data. I'll just separate you all into, you know, clusters. And then you can all go off and form working groups and do, you know, whatever you like. So some of them were really, you know, there was a few of us that really wanted to do mentoring. Some people wanted to go and work on, like, you know, company policy. Some of them wanted to just do, you know, they wanted to be actively in the community to represent our, you know, our industry. So came in there, structured it all up, created some working groups. Over time, we did find that, I suppose, you know, people have good intentions, but, you know, for whatever reason, the motivation and the execution, you know, plateaus a little bit. Then eventually we kind of then, you know, stripped it all back, created another group, which is effectively building pride of the people that really wanted to do something and were ready, I suppose, to get their, you know, to get their hands dirty and take
well,
it and leave
you
it.
Also do have a bit of a personal motto, which is getting shit done. So I think you and I both, you know, that's sort of where we connect is, and I don't want to be sitting around giving up an hour of my time if I'm not getting an outcome out of it. There needs to be something happening. Yeah.
Yeah, it's do you know, it's funny. People look at me as like I'm some expert in this field. And when I remember the day that I walked into this meeting and I thought to myself, oh my God, there's so many people here. They're so smart. They know everything they're talking about. And I'm not saying they weren't smart, but I do think that they definitely were passionate about it, but I don't necessarily think they got outcomes. I will say that one of the biggest flaws, I suppose, in a lot of the socially progressive movements is, you know, people let perfection get in the way of progress. And I think some of the best organizations who actually know how to lay rubber down on the road and actually, you know, be able to take steps forward, understand that you can't be sitting there in a world of ideals and basically not moving forward because, you know, you're worried you might offend somebody or you might do this or maybe this or have, like, it's like with business, like everything you do.
That's where I sit there and I think it's exactly like, you know, starting a business. You just got to go. You're going to fuck up.
Yeah.
You're going to get things wrong. Shit's going to happen. But if you don't, as you say, that sounds like it's the whole mantra of your family. Just go and give it a go. Yeah.
Don't ever expect that anything is the finished product and just realize that, you know, you're going to be smart enough to know that, you know, you're going to make mistakes, you'll correct them and you'll get better and you'll get better at it the next time and the next time and the next time. And I think that's why we've kind of, you know, I suppose had the mark we've had, and it has. And truth be told, you know, there are some moments that I look at the group that we've got and some of the amazing, you know, people in our working group that have put their hand up. You know, even when we go to Mardi Gras every single year and I don't get involved. They design it. I just turn up on the day. I teach them how to dance. And I look at the float that they pull together and every year it is bigger and it is phenomenal. And I just, it actually kind of, there is a part of me that is really proud to think that, you know, I don't create that, but I kind of create an environment where people can go and create that and they
absolutely
get to express themselves, and it's phenomenal.
I mean, I got involved in this. I remember there was something that went out and one of our partners who identifies, you know, sort of brought it to my attention, you know, and I was like, oh, okay. So we went to an event in Sydney. It was massive at Lendlease. There's like 150 people at this breakfast. There was a conversation going on. And it was brilliant. And just the energy in the room. And I was like, you know, this is incredible. So since then, let's talk about some of the things, because, you know, there are groups out there that do, and I think it's great. I think there's a real benefit to bringing people together and you feel all that, you know, yay, we're all getting in. You're creating a community in essence. But I think for you, building pride isn't just about having a collective and events and parties. For you, it's also a drive in actually wanting to improve. So let's talk about some of the initiatives. So you've done mentoring. You've got a mentoring program that Building Pride runs. I'll list some of them off and then you come in just in case there's things in it. I think one of the big ones I do want to talk about is the trade and obviously the more blue collar on site side of things. And then, you know, you've also done this survey and the research that you've done as well. I mean, you personally do a lot of speaking at events and opening people up into thinking about that. But Building Pride isn't just about talking and coming together and having drinks. You've actually got a lot of other really good initiatives going on that is about data and making change.
Yeah,
and
I
the
think
gender neutral.
You're right. Look, I think you're right. There's a lot of people to do a lot of networking groups and a lot of, you know, come together to have conversations. For me in particular, I've always had the, I suppose, the perspective that, you know, if you want to create change, it's not about, you know, preaching to the choir.
Absolutely.
It's actually how do you kind of have conversations with, you know, those on the fringes or those outside to actually give them, to get them, I suppose, to have some, you know, perspective and some empathy and some understanding. And I think that's where the art about, you know, how are you actually having these conversations that are leaving a legacy or leaving a mark or having an impact on people. And, you know, you mentioned some of the public speaking that, you know, that I do. Over the years, I get asked to do a lot of talks, and I always hate, I suppose, not giving people value for money. So what we've now started to do is, from a lot of the topics that we start to frame up and come up with themes, it's what do we do with that conversation? And in most cases, the people in the room are not the ones that actually need to hear that conversation. Mm. So, you know, this year we've been having discussions around psychological safety. And that was beyond the legislation, the legislative changes that have kind of come into play here. But it's more just about what does it actually mean for creating a safe working environment for people, and what does that actually mean for business? What does it mean for the individual? You know, we always talk about a war for talent. We're talking about talent attraction and retention. We talk about productivity. So all of these things that are actually linked under this umbrella of psychological safety. But what happened was that I started to get asked to speak, and I said, look, I'm happy to come in and speak, but you know what I will do is I'll give you my notes, or let's record the conversation. I'll pull it together and I'll give it to you as some type of takeaway, because I would love nothing more than for you to go back to your organization and say, oh wow, I heard Crystal speak and he talked about this really good topic on psychological safety or what it means about an inclusive workplace But here are some facts and here's some data that they pulled together through some of their research, and here are some takeaways for business. And at least that piece of paper is that legacy that they can go back to their organization, that they can turn around and say, it was more than just, yeah, I supported an inclusion event or a gender equality event. Or, and I'm sure you've seen it too, Seaton, especially when it comes to a lot of the female-led initiatives, for trying to get greater female participation in property and construction, where are the men in the room? So how do you give them something that will actually go back so that they can go and talk to their organization and say, this is why we should be doing it. This is why we need to be having this conversation. So that was I think that's kind of been an evolution of public speaking into that. Psychological safety is a huge part. We're doing a deeper dive on psychological safety at the moment around, because we talk about mental health and wellness, and understanding that you've got people in this kind of survival mode, and I'm dealing with trauma, barely waking up in the morning, turning up to work, to I want to be my best self and I want to be at my peak performance and I love my job and I really want to focus on my career. And they're two very different states of mind, but they are all linked to mental wellness and mental health.
Absolutely. So what did you find in some of the surveys and the latest report? So give us a little bit of an insight.
Yeah, I suppose one of the interesting things is, and I like to, whenever we have these conversations, I always try to focus it around business. This is good business sense.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you're not going to convince anybody to do anything if there's no, at the end of the day, we're not funded by the government. It's not a non-for-profit. It's not philanthropy. You have to be doing things that commercially stack up. Otherwise, you don't have a business to provide people with jobs to do it. And that's the point in a bit.
Look, I think one of the pieces that blows my mind, and as a 38-year-old, that Gen Z now represents a third of the workforce. Mm-hmm. So you can have a lot of managers, if they don't actually understand that one third of their talent pool, and, a very savvy talent pool. When you talk about things like AI and, having these tools that they will grow up on them and know them like the back of their hand, that, you need these people into their business. But, there's data out there that says, Gen Z is a third of the workforce, that, in this day and age, in 2025, there was one piece of research done that they are actually looking for, that they want employers that support their psychological and physical safety and wellness, right? They want an employer that will actually help them in their pursuit of mental and physical wellness, not just turn up and provide me an environment that makes me feel safe. They actually want somebody that really understands that, I want to wake up in the morning and, make sure I've got time for my run club or go to the gym during the day, because that's important for me, for my, for my mental wellness. And it's a very different conversation to, what we were having, say, 15 years ago when we were talking about flexible working. you know, a flexible working was, you know, about being able to leave a little bit early because you've got kids or something like that. So it is a very different makeup of the workforce that's coming in. And it's a little bit, yeah, you know, you could say that they're needy, but that's them. This is what they want. And truth be told, I look at my father and my uncle and growing up around when we'd go on holidays, they would be connected by fax machines to a hotel. Lucky them. You know, so things moved a lot slower. In our generation now, we are so connected to technology, and it's a good thing, but it's also a horrible thing. We don't switch off. We are always connected. Yeah. Our minds are always on. So, you know, how do you now find that balance of, you know, this I'm always connected to my job, to how do I then disconnect and also then look after myself, and what does looking after myself look like?
Oh, I mean, we have massive digital fatigue, and we actually, you know, one of our businesses, that's what we run, is a whole program on actually how to mentally get yourself into that physical well-being. And I mean, I think that's both something you and I share, is keeping that balance and keeping, you know, even if you work slightly less hours, you can produce more. It's like my team. I'm like, I really don't care the hours you work, as long as it gets you done. Like, that's the main thing. If you work 4 hours and you're better on that day, or you need 8 because you're tired, please just go and get rest and do that, because you'll actually come back and be able to do it that way. But that's not something that we see. You know, there's still that 7.6 hour, you know, for a 38-hour week, or, you know, most people, particularly in professional services, still thinking, if you're on construction sites or on site, you know, it's starting really early in the morning, in the afternoon. I will say it's one of the things Queenslanders do very well. I think they have the balance side of things worked out, and I think it's actually a good thing. I think it's hard when you come from Melbourne, Sydney, like, oh, what do you mean? It's like, no, they're actually out in nature most weekends. They're actually doing things. People are actually very involved in a community. It's not just it's good weather. There's lots of things that actually happen that people naturally do. But I think, yes, it is being driven by technology and things like that. It is the next generation who's learning different things at school. But also in the next 20 to 30, 40 years, the way that we work, the way that we interact, how we're operating, what skill sets that we're going to need are fundamentally going to continue to evolve. The one thing that's not going to change really is our ability to interconnect as people and humans. And we're actually seeing that was one of the things we had from an earlier podcast, is that with this, we're actually seeing more disconnection, and we're actually seeing an inability to relate to people can sometimes decrease, which is why I think the building industry, I think I love the whole built environment, is because if you want to get a project done, you have to work together. There's no anybody's working in isolation. It's a very collaborative industry. And, you know, we've got to get something done. It has to be built to a certain part. And, you know, there's lots of factors that work in there. So in regards to some of the other programs, so you've also done a whole gender neutral bathrooms, which was something that was an event we were at the other day at John Holland. And actually, maybe it's only because I'm not on the building code side of things, but I didn't realise that one of the first things to do that was you actually had to tender, and I think Building Pride has put something in to actually change bathrooms, because you have to specify a male and female bathroom. Is that correct?
Yeah, there are certain – so this is I'll put it in the most simplistic way that I can put it, because there's a lot of people that have been working behind the scenes in terms of building code, from a design perspective, to actually have some of the code changed around the amount of amenity that you need to have. But do you know what's really interesting? One of the best examples of where we had a, you know, when we say all gender amenity, was actually there were two places in Victoria, and they was at the National Gallery, and also at Federation Square. So sometimes I find this a really funny conversation, because there's a lot of people that want to go through this formal process to have it embedded, which I can see why we want to do it, because it's like, well, we want an all-gender amenity. How do we make sure that when we're going for a building application perspective that we can actually have it? What does that look like? But, you know, not having it separate from everything, because we don't want to give up that, you know, that real estate or that, you know, NRA for these types of things. But they actually just want to put them in. And I find this very funny, because there's a few examples of places where they've just said, no, we're just putting all gender amenities over there, and just no one said anything, right? And sometimes I feel it's kind of become this bigger than Ben Hur, because there's unfortunately, especially, you know, with everything that's happening, you know, in the world at the moment, you know, there's a lot of people that seem to pick, you know, the lowest hanging fruit, which is the trans community, and they become, you know, political football. And the battleground is the gender bathroom. And, you know, and the examples of what people give are in, and the hypotheticals are not the the realities of life. And they are not, you know, they don't reflect, you know, what does, you know, the trans movement actually mean or what they're looking for, right? But it seems to be the one sticking point that people seem to be going back to, like, you know, everyone's going to hang out in the bathroom and someone's hiding in, you know, in the wrong amenity for, you know, for whatever reason. In my opinion, it's a very overly complicated piece of discussion that I think people enjoy seeing it get overly complicated, where there's some really simple solutions.
Okay, so let's talk through some of those, which I think are fantastic. So what are some very simple solutions that people can approach?
Do you know what's interesting? It always comes down to, like, leadership. And I do, though, I will say this, I will preface this conversation, so I do think it's around the and it's depending on the asset that you're going to. So there's been a couple of like major landlords that have actually introduced all gender amenities into their spaces. So I think Westfield at Sydney CBD did it about 6 or 7 years ago. Stockland have done it. You know, so there is, I feel like where there is a will and that you can make provision for it and you just put them in, no one says anything. It just gets done. It goes through. Yeah. People go in and they pick the amenity that, you know, aligns the gender that they identify with. They go in, they go to the bathroom, they leave. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's become a bit of a political football thing. To be honest with you, it will get there, and they will come up with a building code for it at some point in time. But yeah, it's there's plenty.
So
plenty
what's
of examples
building pride? I know it's been a conversation. So what's building pride be working on in that? Is that as a project in the back end?
Look, at the start, we had set it up to get a couple of people in the room that were really passionate about it, and a lot of it did come from the building surveyors and from the architects. And then from that point on, there we just let it go. We had a few companies come to us to ask the question around whether or not, you know, like how to do it, and to which we actually had introduced them to some of the building surveyors and the architects had done it, and then they implemented it, and then you don't hear boo.
You don't hear boo.
But again, it comes back to, you know, we set a really clear precedent. This is what we want. This is what we want in our office, and it gets done. It's no different to going and putting a shower, you know, a shower amenity, or an end of trip facility.
What you're saying is people overthink things. It's not that complicated. But if anybody is wanting or thinking about that, very much reach out to you, and you can put them in touch with the right people who have done some great examples and things like that. Yeah. I think that's one of the things when you talk about it, you know, I think what Building Pride has done the last few years is actually already changed quite a few things in the conversation. It's become a lot more normalized. So there's things that came up probably early on that are now like, oh, okay, we've looked at and addressed that, and there's very easy solutions is what you're saying in that case as well. So let's talk a little bit about, because obviously it's all very well for everybody who sits in an office or white collar roles in corporate. Obviously Building Pride has been also working very hard on what's actually happening on site, you know, and I think from anybody I know, particularly on the professional services side, they can feel 100% comfortable, right? Whether it's part of the community or even women at sometimes, and then you go onto site and you might feel a completely feel unsafe in comparison. And if that's your main work site, your main workplace every single day, that can have a big effect. And I know most people probably, like, you know, at the football club aren't really necessarily that open about their sexuality, and obviously, you know, maybe talking more males and females or those who identify as more of those genders. So let's have a little bit of a chat about what Building Pride has been doing and some of the fantastic programs you've been running on site.
Yeah, the site, you know, it's funny, there's no silver bullet for the on-site inclusion piece, and I'll talk through a little bit about why that is. But the one thing in all of the programs and initiatives that we've run with certain businesses that they've wanted to kind of, you know, I suppose, run an initiative on their actual work site to, you know, run an inclusion idea or campaign around, you know, like an Ida Hobbit, or they'll come and do toolbox talks to, you know, for Wear It Purple Day or something like this, is I always remind people, and to me, I think that this is where the biggest deficiency seems to be around this, is we often forget that that our construction sites are a workplace. And I think that we don't really respect or appreciate the fact that the project leaders, whether they be project directors or construction managers who are literally responsible for that site, have a responsibility for making sure that, you know, that the culture on site is one that includes all. And I think that, you know, there's been so many examples of this when we talk about, you know, why does, you know, bullying, harassment happen in construction on construction sites, yet it doesn't happen within the office. And truth be told, it comes down to leadership on site. You know, we turn a blind eye to things and things that get said that, you know, you would never get away with within an office space.
Yeah.
So it, you know, it begs the question, why? You know, what? Why is this? Why do we accept a lower standard of behaviour? You know, in certain areas. And look, I suppose the easiest and simplistic answer to that is that people come from, you know, in these roles, they've got very good technical skills. Hence why, you know, they're on construction sites. You know, they've delivered before major projects. They understand these things, how to happen. But are they great people managers? They might be able to get a project outcome, but, you know, are they looking at the performance of people? And I think, you know, is it because, you know, everything on a construction site is subcontracted out, that they don't actually treat subcontractors like that they are their own staff and employees? And so maybe they don't feel like they have this, I wouldn't say duty of care, but maybe they don't see that the subcontractor is effectively, you know, somebody that they should be, I suppose, you know, making sure they're providing a safe and inclusive environment for. So I feel that this is why it's always been this kind of really tough one to crack. However, there've been some examples of, you would probably start to look at the companies that run some really good sites because they've got really good leaders in place running those sites. And I think that's one of the most important things when it comes to actually how do you make change or how do you make sites more inclusive. It really does start at the company level about when they're running, you know, when they're running projects, is do they actually have the leadership skills that's actually required if they were, you know, running a business? You know, do they have this narrative that, you know, the behavior that they walk, you know, by is the behavior that they're willing to accept? You know, because if they do, then maybe you would start to question, you know, a lot of things as to whether or not they actually have leadership material. So yeah. The on-site thing is also an interesting one, also from, I suppose, a subculture perspective. And if you've ever been in in the lunchrooms on a construction site, I suppose let's have a conversation on mental health. There's obviously a big movement in the last, say, 10 years to get, you know, men to have conversations around mental health. You know, we have Are You Okay Day. We've got, you know, initiatives like Mates in Construction. Basically, you're asking men to allow them to have a space where they can share what's going on with their life, as opposed to, you know, putting up a, you know, facade and, you know, talking really simplistic about, you know, what happened, you know, over their weekend or footy or something like this.
Yeah.
And I feel that, you know, the on-site inclusion piece goes hand in hand with the mental health piece, that at the end of the day, you're wanting to create an environment for anyone to come and be themselves without ridicule or without judgment, and also understand that everybody is going through something. So how do you create a safe and supportive environment for people like that? Just because someone is a member of the queer community should be actually no different than to somebody who's actually going through a hard time. And I think that we forget about that. There is this ultimate human element about we just want people to come to work and be their best self and love coming to work because, you know, for various reasons, you know, you obviously want to get the best out of your people. And I feel that kind of gets forgotten along the way. There's definitely a lot of people that work on construction sites that we've spoken to that, you know, concreters, there's actually, you know, we've actually had a fair few concreters and stuff, they would never come out on site. They just said, you know what, it's just not worth it. The small talk, the you know, it's very superficial. I just don't need people to know that side of my private life.
Yeah.
And they choose to not, you know, and they choose to withhold that. And I, for me personally, I think as long as they're comfortable doing that, that's great. But some people will just say, look, I come in, I clock off, I go home, and that's it. I'll see you later.
Yeah.
Maybe that's right for one generation. Whether or not that's right for the next generation, I challenge that.
Well, I think the thing is, I mean, and that's a little bit related to my sort of story before coming into the industry. The organization I worked in before was, you know, all males and all the leadership team, you know, females sort of, you know, there was definitely a type, let's put it this way. I probably got in because I was blonde, to be honest with you. And my partner was my housemate, right? And that was a shit thing, you know, to go to work and be like, oh, I can't really say. Now, I'm not saying that I suppose when you're coming out in your 20s, you're not, you know, you're not really thinking about these things. But it was very nice to come into an environment. And I know, you know, I joined a company called Grey Puxand, and I remember the week that I joined, it was about the same time as the same-sex marriage equality. And they actually had an internal conversation. They actually then put up that they were supporting it. And that was like one of the biggest things. I was like, I want to work for this company because it's out, versus having worked for a company where I had HRD who was like, oh, any people with diversity and inclusion have diversity and inclusion policies. And I was like, I think our values might be slightly misaligned here. In essence, I know what that's like to go to work and to go, it's not really worth me sharing my personal life. My personal life's my personal life. That's it. My work life's my work life. But geez, it feels like crap as well, because you don't ever feel like you're ever going to be in that environment where you're going to be connecting. Now, mind you, I'm a knowledge worker, right? So I'm in an office, I'm interrelating with the same people. That could definitely be something that is different on site. But I think it's the same thing of it. We have the conversation around gender is the same thing. So my partner, you know, walked into a construction company. There'd been females working there before. So my partner's a general manager in construction, been there before. They didn't have any sanitary pad like bunch. It's like the guys like, what's this new thing? They're the sanitary pad guys, because you haven't freaking organized that. You know, you don't think about this when you're sending things on site. Where is the female meant to go? You know, oh, she's been going off to the toilet all the time. What's going on? I don't understand. Mate, do you think it's happening once a month? Does there seem to be a cycle to it? Could that be one of the reasons? So there's all these types of things that people don't necessarily, and that's a gender, you know, obviously a female gender part I'm bringing up there. But at the end of the day, I don't think it's, you know, belonging is one of those things. I don't think you're ever going to get the best out of a person or have that if you can't create some sort of inclusion. And as you said, and I think you've identified it very, very well, if people don't feel safe being able to talk about their mental health or where they're at, it's the same thing. You know, I don't need to talk about my weekend and I can hide. Oh, what'd you do on the weekend? Oh, I had lunch with the family, whatever, right? I need to say what their family's about. But also that same thing of how you actually going, hey, you look a bit off today. Is everything okay? It's that sub level, that next level down of a depth of a relationship. And I think we started off talking about that from a psych safety point of view, that we want people to be their best. From a business point of view, you want to reduce your turnover and you do want that. So I think that's a fantastic correlation that you've made around mental health, essentially being able to, how comfortable can you be at being able to who you are or go anything further than a facade level in what it is.
Yeah.
And as you said, everybody's got shit going on, right? That's the lovely part about the complexities of being a human, is that we've always got something's happening probably somewhere in our lives. I think that's a great insight. And as you said, I think the leadership always makes a difference. Right? Like, I'm just giving you an example. If you've got an HRD who's saying that type of stuff, that's not an environment. If you've got a construction, you know, a construction manager is willing to work past and is okay with the, there's friendly jabs, and then there's, mate, not appropriate. And I often, as an HR person, have people come up to me and say, oh, how do we do this? I'm like, first thing is just pull them aside and have a very polite conversation. Say, look, I understand that, but that's not okay, you know, and I've had to do it myself because I'm dyslexic. Yeah. I've had somebody say something and say, look, I'm actually this, I understand that, but that type of behavior is not acceptable, and particularly as a leader, you need to understand that. I think the thing is that none of us are perfect either, by the way, and I don't know about you, but if I was doing something that wasn't right, I'd also want somebody to come up to me and say, I don't think you meant it to come off like this, but I think you just need to be aware that the way that you're actually acting is actually having this effect. Isn't that great? I mean, I don't know about you, but I try and surround myself with friends who are a bit like that as well. Brilliant. Is there anything you'd like to add on that, Chris?
Yeah, no, I think, look, I think that one of the areas that we've been really successful on, and I think this is just goes to show you about, like, if you put an idea out there, just what can come of it. Through the work we've done with Building Pride, we've had so many people, you know, we've analyzed so many people. We've had about, I think, 20 people approach us with just these random kind of, you know, concerns, and they've needed assistance. You know, I've had a couple of people say, listen, you know, I'm transgender. I would love to go and become an apprentice. I would love to, you know, do my apprenticeship, but I don't know any companies, or I don't know where to start. Could you please, you know, connect me into some? And then I'll kind of put some emails out there into our little ecosystem. And, you know, you get companies back and be like, you know, we would love to support this individual. Absolutely. And, you know, we caveat with a bit of a go and have a conversation, see how you feel. You know, we can set you up with a good mentor. You know, because, you know, they're aware that, you know, it's not going to be the easiest ride, or maybe they're preparing themselves for it's not going to be the easy ride. So how can you make that easier? How can you make them feel comfortable? And, you know, especially when someone is looking to build a career. So we've had, you know, some great examples of things like this. We've had people that have struggled to find their place within the industry. And I think it's a bit of a balance around their own, you know, personal identity and professional identity. And we've seen them kind of through our mentor program, find really strong mentors and, you know, help them get place and go on and, you know, they've built careers. So it's, I think they're the most little rewarding things. And I think that, you know, with every talk, or, you know, if it's a public speaking gig that we do, if it's a mentor program, you know, if it's, you know, helping somebody from an email that they say that they're looking to, you know, get an apprenticeship, if all you do is help like one person and you're helping like one person every 2 months, I feel like we're doing something right. And I think that's how you can kind of actually measure to know whether or not you're having impact. And I think you forget that it can just be the easiest thing by just being visible, being present, and just, you know, helping somebody through connections and, you know, how much of an impact that will actually have on their life.
Yeah. And oh, look, I love that. I think you're talking about there's the idealistic and then there's the individualistic, as in, you know, you can have the idealistic, all this theory, and then it actually comes down to this person and the situation they're going through, and that's mentoring and that particular part. And I think that's a fantastic thing, Chris. I think anybody listening to this or is interested in this, wants to connect, I think, you know, that's the great thing. You know, Building Pride and other groups, it's actually about a network and using that network to be able to help out where you can and to connect people, as much as it is about, you know, looking at different areas and trying to improve things as well. So brilliant. All right. So just to round up, Chris, if people want to get involved in Building Pride, how do they do that?
Yeah, the best way to do it is to look. We do focus a lot on through LinkedIn, because LinkedIn is, you know, a professional network, and that's kind of where we kind of announce any type of event happening in Melbourne, Sydney, Brisbane, or a mentor program, or anything that goes on. That's the best way to do it. We've got our website as well. That's also like a good little piece of you know, resource. So a lot of the white papers we're discussing before from some of our talks, we do put them there as a bit of a leave behind, and they're all free. And then there's just, you know, if people want to get involved in any different way, you know, like reach out to us, we'll see what we can do. As I said, we're volunteer led. We try our best to help people. You know, we don't let, you know, perfection get in the way of progress. So we try to make, you know, incremental steps and try to have little quick wins along the way.
Yeah, brilliant. Excellent. All right, now we generally finish off, but you may not have had a chance to think about if there was a book, a podcast, or something that you're listening to we think is relevant to this area, is there a resource that you would recommend people go and have a listen or a think about?
No. I mean, I didn't do any anything on this. However, I will say this. I do read a lot of autobiographies, a lot of biographies, and I think they give me a lot of perspective rather than just kind of leadership books on, you know, what makes good business. But I do think understanding people's personal stories and their own struggles and challenges is always really, really amazing. Elliot Page, the trans actor, they've done their book called Page Boy, and I found it really fascinating as somebody who is deeply talented. to, you know, was a childhood Hollywood star, talk about, I suppose, the politics in Hollywood, and also as a person who was trying to find themselves, you know, as a queer member of the community. I think it really does, it's really important sometimes, especially with the trans community, to actually put that human side to it, because I think that we forget about that and it gets lost in a lot of headlines. So that was the last read that I've done. But I do think, you know, it's always great just to put some perspective on it, because we often forget, and people say, why do you do this? And I think, you know, you don't know who's a member of the queer community. It could be a parent, it could be a sibling, it could be your child, it could be your best friend, and their challenges are always very different. So, you know, maybe some understanding what they're going through and how you can support them is super important.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think that's it. It is about empathy and understanding is always a first point in awareness as well. Brilliant, Chris. Thank you so much for joining us today. We'll go from there.
Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and subscribe. If you're liking this podcast, please rate it, because it will actually help other people as well. Now, beyond being able to subscribe, we also have a fantastic newsletter. So if you go to the be-connected.co podcast, you will actually be able to sign up for a newsletter, and you will get this on a weekly basis with the latest podcast coming out twice a month, and a fantastic newsletter that will give you great insights into the industry, interesting topics of how you can grow professionally and also grow your businesses. We hope you enjoy, and thanks so much for listening.